Okay, I think we can get started. Boker Tov, everybody. We are continuing Perkei Avot. We're at Mishnah Perek Beit in my Mishnah Yud. Mishnah Yud. We're discussing the actually Mishnah Yud Aleph. We're going to start Rabbi Yoshua Omer. We're discussing the five students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. That seems to be an interesting number when it comes to rabbinic students. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had five students. The Gemara says Rabbi Akiva had five students. There were the five students at the B'nai Brak at the Pesach Seder. I don't know, somehow interesting, they mentioned who are the five major students. So that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, the individual character traits, at least of some of the rabbis. Some rabbis we know a lot more about than others. Often what we do know, we gather from what their teachings are. So last week we discussed Rabbi Eliezer. You should be very much honoring your friend and your neighbor. And then we ended off discussing sort of the relationship to rabbis or to authority, that you have to like heat and light. You can get heat if you're far, if you can get light if you're far away, but yeah, to get heat, you have to be close. And there's this like tension in our tradition about how close a student should get to a teacher. There is a sort of a strain in our tradition that I would say that when it comes to, you know, Torah is so holy and so powerful and so electrifying, it's dangerous. It's like if you get too close, it can kill you, like Nadav and Avihu, you know, probably got too close. And there's this notion you have to be be'ema, be'ira, with fear and trembling. And when you learn, and that was the original custom, people used to stand when they learned Torah. How can you sit when you learn Torah? You have to stand like nervous, like when you're in court, you have to stand. The litigants have to stand in a court case, whatever. So that's the one sort of idea that Torah is very, you have to tremble before Torah, as we read in the Torah at Mamad Har Sinai, the trembling of the Jewish people. That's on the one hand. It's probably not a style that works so well. In other words, there's this other hand. Of course, you want to get close, and the closer you are, the more you learn. And we know we have students questioning their teachers, et cetera, et cetera. But there is this little bit of notion that one should be kind of distant from the authorities of Torah. But like I mentioned, I think in the generation we live in today, that system doesn't work so well. People have to feel a little bit closer to their teachers. There have to be a, you know, like I think I mentioned before, it's I think it's true. It's important that a student like a teacher, otherwise they're not going to learn. Anyway, but there is this tension between how close you should get. But here the Mishnah was saying that in order to really learn, it's got to be like heat. You got to be close by. If you learn just from a distance, you really can't get so far. That's why, like when Rabbi Akiva went to, when Moshe Rabbeinu went to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, he sat in the back. You know, everybody knows that. If you're not too into something, you know, go to shul and you don't know anybody, or you're in a strange city, so you always sit in the back. You know, nobody notices you. If you want to really get involved in what's going on, you have to move up to the front. So that's the same thing. You want to get involved in Torah, you got to move up to the front. Got to be close. You got to be like got to get the heat of the rabbis, but watch that their bite is like a snake or a scorpion. Okay, let's.
Oh, Rabbi, I have a question. What about the Shabbos Shuvah drasha and fear and all of that? Does that carry the same degree of awe and reverence?
Yeah, listen, so you know, there was a custom. I know some people gave the Shabbos Agadol and Shabbos, you know, Shuvah drasha. It's really, you know, that's sort of a Eastern European invention, I think. That the rabbi would wear a talis when he spoke. It was a very formal occasion. Listen, I remember Rav Schechter once describing to us the difference between the Pesach Seder of Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and the Netziv. A lot of it is your personal attitude. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, you know, very nervous. You know, what's the shear of the kazayit? How big is the wine? You know, are we drinking enough? Everybody, they're very nervous about the halacha, not relaxed. You know, there are certain people like that. And halacha can sometimes make you like that. You know, it has so many details. It can, someone who can drive you, you know, crazy in a sense. And then the tzeiv was much more relaxed, enjoy, fun. You know, so a lot of it is a personal thing. But, you know, how... how awe-inspiring. Like I said, I don't know that works today, but we'll discuss a little bit more hopefully later today on sort of on the Mussar movement a little bit. But you know, listen, the rabbi's speech is whatever works best. That's what you're supposed to. We mentioned once before that Rav used to tell a joke before every shiur. That's a very different approach. You know, because if you want to loosen up people, you want to relate to people, you begin with a joke. And I mentioned Rav Schechter used to tell us there's a debate in the commentaries. Is the joke only allowed at the beginning of the class, like before you start to warm people up? But once you're actually learning, you shouldn't tell jokes. And some say no, even in the middle. I think we live in a generation, you have to tell jokes. If anybody heard Rav Schechter speak, he has a great sense of humor. He would tell jokes in the middle of the show. I mean, not like he wouldn't stop and tell a story, but you know, a speaker can speak in a way that's very cute and with a sense of humor. So whatever, it depends on the approach that works. But there are some rabbis who are very distant. There were, I don't want to start mentioning names now, but there was a famous Rosh Yeshiva that when you went to meet with him, you had to walk out of the room backwards. You know, some people at the Kotel, they won't turn their back. In other words, they walk away from the Kotel facing the Kotel because it's not nice to turn your back. So there was a famous Rosh Yeshiva. You had to turn your... I don't know if it was, I'm not saying he was personal, he felt, but out of kavod haTorah, respect for the Torah, you don't turn your back on a Rosh Yeshiva, you walk out of the room facing him. I mean, so these are different approaches to, you know, how we relate to people. Or when I was in yeshiva, when I came to Israel in yeshiva, so I found it extremely strange. I could never do this, where you have students would talk to their rebbeim, talk to their Rosh Yeshiva in third person. The rabbi said, and I think Rav Lichtenstein told us once, he felt very uncomfortable with that. You know, I would feel very uncomfortable if somebody spoke to me in third person. But for some people, that's a great mark of respect and honor. So, you know, you have to know who you're dealing with, who you are. And like all these things, it changes. That's probably the reason why when it comes to mitzvot between man and man, there's very little in the Torah describing the mitzvot. In other words, how do you define honoring your parents? Forget just in the Torah, in our halachic codes. Kibud av v'em, let's say, which is an extremely important mitzvah, is one siman, I believe, in the Shulchan Aruch. That's it. A few halachas. Because how it applies changes from generation to generation. I think, you know, also the relationship between kids and parents is much different than it used to be a few generations ago. The relationship between teachers and students. So these halakhas are not codified because the definition of respect can often change from generation. There's certain objective things. I'll even, if you want a little bit more controversial, and even in the area of tzniut. The definition of tzniut was never really defined in Judaism because it couldn't be defined and it should not be defined because every generation is a little bit different. Today, we live in an era where people like to define everything, you know, exactly how big an olive is or how, you know, how much, how long the sleeve has to be or this. It's not the way the halachic system used to work. Maybe there are reasons for it in our generation, but a lot of things, you know, Hilchot Shabbos is more objective. What's allowed in one generation, you know, it doesn't change much. I mean, there are new technologies you have to figure out, but the halakhas aren't going to change. But how to honor somebody or how to interact or how to learn Torah, that changes from generation to generation. And therefore, the halakha was very well aware of that and just gave very broad outlines, allowing people to develop it with their own generation. Okay, hope that answered the question. But let's get to Rabbi Yehoshua. We got a few things to discuss. Ayin Hara, this is Perek Beit Mishnah Yud Aleph, 2:11 in my Mishnah. Ayin Hara, a bad eye, v'yetzer hara, an evil inclination, v'sinat habriyot, that we'll talk about, of course, leading up to Tisha B'Av, the hatred of creation, motzi'im et ha'adam min ha'olam, remove somebody from the world. These three things, so that's also a very interesting expression, remove you from the world. So is that like it kills you internally or you're punished? It's a very, like we sometimes have an expression, mitchayev b'nafsho, like a person does something, he's guilty of a death penalty. But that's not what it says here. It's not that you're guilty. What we're saying here is if you have these traits, if you have a bad eye, we'll just find that in a minute, with this yetzer hara and sinat b'nafsho, it will kill you. Motzi metad min olam, you know, it'll create stress, give you a heart condition, give you all kinds of terrible things. Ayin Hara, we discussed a few weeks ago when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked his students. Very interesting. It was Rabbi Eliezer who said that Ayin Tov and Ayin Ra are the good and the bad traits. Now, good eye we define generally as not to be jealous. A good eye means your neighbor has more than you, you smile, you're very happy for him. You don't look down, you know, we know a good eye. You give somebody a look, a glare, that says it all. You don't have to say anything. So Ayin Hara is generally basically how we relate to other people, how we look at the other people. Are we jealous of them? So I don't have to tell you how that can kill you. If your whole life is spent, you know, I have to be number one. You know, we live in a world where all people, it's, you know, in the business world, it's your market share. They don't even care necessarily as much as how much, you know, I don't want to have to mute everybody again, but there is a little bit of background noise. So if somebody has their mute off, please turn it off. Okay, otherwise. So companies care very much market share, often sometimes more than revenue and profit. I understand that on a certain level, but on a certain level, it's actually very sad. If you're doing well, like, so somebody else is also doing well, Baruch Hashem. The famous story, you know, the Chafetz Chaim, okay, we're not the Chafetz Chaim, you know, they owned a little store. And everybody, when they opened up a store, he didn't want to make a living from Torah. That was the classical approach. So him and his wife opened up a store and everybody went shopping and rode into his store. Because the Chafetz Chaim, you have to support him. So he felt that wasn't right. It was hurting the other merchants. So he only opened up his store, I don't know, 2 hours a day. So everybody went shopping during those 2 hours. So he closed the store. You know, I don't know if the story is true, but all right. And I don't know that we have to do that. But the idea that it's okay that other people do well, there's no mitzvah for you to have 100%. You know, market share. Anyways, so Ayin Hara, now talk a little bit about Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination. So an evil inclination can kill you. We know, the Chait, we have Yetzer Hara, you know, how everybody knows what our Yetzer Hara is. Everybody, again, has their own individual Yetzer Hara. I think that, you know, that's, everybody has to know what their area that they have to work on. We also know the Medrash famously says that without the Yetzer Hara, we couldn't live. Without the Yetzer Hara, there would be no children. Without the Yetzer Hara, nobody would engage in business. It is good to want to do well in business. Being wealthy is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to strive for, as long as it's in perspective. As long as you don't have an Ayin Hara for other people. I don't mean Ayin Hara the way people use it. You know, an Ayin Hara means how you look upon other people. So we need a Yetzer Hara that God created with the Yetzer Hara, because without the Yetzer Hara, we wouldn't do anything. There is a, I don't know if people are familiar, relatively, I don't know if it's relatively well known, I think. The Gemara says that, and I guess their aunts, they were bothered by the fact, you know, if you read now, we're doing a series on Tanakh. It's really a very fascinating series. I invite everybody to join. We've just finished Nevi'im Rishonim. So we got 9 of the 24 books done, one book in every class. So you read Nevi'im Rishonim, it's like unbelievable. Of the Avodah Zarah, the idolatry, worshiping idols and Baal and all kinds of crazy things. It's just really astounding. What was the draw of people to Avodah Zarah? So that's a fascinating question we're not going to get into now. It wasn't some simplicity. They didn't worship an idol and think. It was a more sophisticated. It wasn't so silly. They had a sophisticated approach, how it worked a little bit. But what was the draw? We don't have that draw anymore. We don't have people doing that. We have people not observant, but we don't have people who don't worship anybody. But the idea of worshiping Baal and sacrifice and even human sacrifice, you know, they were so close to their gods that they would offer human beings, which on a certain level makes sense. The Akedah, the old Akedah stories to show us we don't want to do that. But there's something to it. In other words, God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son, that does demonstrate your love of God. So the Torah came along and said, no, so we don't have these desires. So the Gemara says, because the sages prayed, whatever that means, they prayed to God that God should nullify the desire for Avodah Zarah. And he did. And that was it. But you know what happened when God nullified the desire for Yetzer Hara? As we've discussed a number of times, Newton's third law of motion, what applies in the physical world, applies in the spiritual world. If people don't have a yearning for idolatry, they have less of a yearning for God. In other words, the religious yearning went away. When the rabbis prayed to get rid of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, it impacted on our desire to worship God. And that's why so many people are not observant. In other words, have no God is not part of their lifestyle at all. And I've mentioned many times, I think from Rav Cook, I heard this verse from Rabbi Gmar, Rav Shlomo Gmar, those of you in Toronto know him, that Avodah Zarah is not all bad. In other words, it's Avodah. Avodah's worship of God that went foreign. There's something went wrong with it, but the idea it begins as Avodah. They're searching for God. Halavai. It's wonderful they're searching for God. Their search for God is a little mistaken, and the Torah makes a big deal that it's a little mistaken. It's Zara. So that got lost. When we lost the Yetzer Hara for worshiping God in the negative way, we also lost the desire to worship God in the positive way. You have to work hard on it. And then the Gemara says, oh, that worked. That was a neat trick. So the Gemara says, let's get rid of the Yetzer Hara, the inclination for Gilui Arayot, for sexual immorality. So that was a cool thing. And that's what happened. That happened. That was it. There were no eggs to eat anymore. Nobody had children. That was it. And the rabbi said, this ain't working. We got to get back the desire for sexual immorality, because otherwise people won't marry, people won't have kids. So you know, you see it, one went to the other. It's interesting, obviously, if the rabbis felt it was worth it to harm our worship of God, to get rid of Avodah Zarah. You know, if you read the Torah Shebichtav, see, because we don't live in such an environment, we don't feel it the same way. But in the Torah Shebichtav, Avodah Zarah is such an overarching theme. I mean, Sefer Dvarim, that's really the whole book. Sefer Dvarim is Moshe Rabbeinu warning the people every week, don't be like the seven nations. Don't intermarry them. We're going to read next week, intermarriage. Everything. It's all about don't worship God in many places like they do. We have one place to worship God. It's all about Avodah Zarah. It's such a major theme, the first two of the Ten Commandments. That's in later sort of Jewish life, it doesn't become. It's not such a major theme because we don't have so much of Avodah Zarah. So the rabbis were happy to get rid of Avodah Zarah, even if it came at the cost of our worship of God. Of course, they couldn't get rid of Gilui Arayot if it came at the cost of a proper sexual relations, because then we wouldn't be here. So they had to allow the Yetzer Hara for Gilui. In other words, you can't have one without the other. That's what we always say. You can't have good without evil. Can't have evil without good. The greater the potential for evil, the greater the potential for good. So that's about it's misuse Yetzer Hara. Misuse Yetzer Hara can kill you. Can literally kill you. You know, you do things that are wrong and dangerous. And also, one who has, you know, such desires for always doing things, it's not good for them. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more on Sinat HaBriot, since we're in the 9 days and Tisha B'Av this week. Sinat HaBriot, hating people. So we know that if you don't like people, it also creates a lot of stress. Creates a lot of stress for people. So what is the definition of Sinat HaBriot? So the Bartanura says, and we'll start with that, because I guess leading to Tisha B'Av, it's what we call, what the Talmud calls Sinat Chinam, which, by the way, is not such an easy term to translate, Sinat Chinam. So what do we call it? Needless hatred, causes hatred, free hatred. Chinam means no price, a shomer chinam. He watches something without getting paid. And what do you mean chinam? Everybody has a reason for hating somebody. The reason might not be good, but there's no, in other words, it's not that there's no reason. Okay, maybe that's what it means. Sinat chinam, not a good reason, is needless. But I really think sinat chinam is not necessarily, this is a little bit, you know, harder and scarier. It doesn't necessarily mean hatred. It can mean that, of course, but what it more likely means is apathy. You're apathetic about other people. What's ahava, the opposite of sinah, is love, is caring. So if love is caring, and that's what we just said, yetzer hara, yetzer tov, every ayin tov, ayin ra, chaver tov, chaver ra. That's what's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, you know, one to the other. So sinah and ahava have to work together. So if ava means love, in Aramaic, the word hav is to give to others. Ava means you give to others, you care. So sinah just means I don't give to others. I'm apathetic about people. I don't care about people, etc. Okay, I'm just curious. Are people here familiar with the beautiful explanation? It's you often hear it. I hope you hear it every year on Tisha B'Av. It's worthy to hear every year on Tisha B'Av or any time. Then it sees definition of Sinat Chinam. If you want to have a show of hands, I'm just curious if people are aware of his introduction to Sefer Bereishit. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great Rosh Yeshiva in Valashin. Should I go on with it? I don't know what people It's hard talking to a screen. Okay. So the Netziv was the Naftali Svihud of Berlin, had two famous children, 48 years apart in age. Whatever, we're not going to go the whole biography of the Netziv, but he was the great Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva, the Harvard of the Yeshiva world, founded by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the great student of the Vilna Gaon in 1803, closed in 1892. And the Netziv headed the yeshiva for the last 39 years. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, and he had his wife died, and then he married his niece. His niece very much wanted to marry him. She was, you know, 36 younger years younger than he was, and they thought she was crazy and said, no, such an honor to marry. And they had a son, Meir. And that son, Meir, was a Zionist, as was his father. The Netziv was a big supporter. I mean, the Netziv died in 1893, a year after they closed the yeshiva. But the Netziv was a supporter of the Chov of Beit Zion. His son got very involved in the Zionist movement, Meir, and then he hebraized his name to Bar Ilan, Berlin. And when Bar Ilan University was founded, they named Bar Ilan University. That's the that's the grandson. That's the son of the Netziv. The granddaughter of the Netziv married Shaul Lieberman from Slobodka, the JTS, the Yon Tosefta. Shaul Lieberman married the Netziv's granddaughter. I mean, everybody, they all married each other, all the great Torah scholars, families. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik married the Netziv's granddaughter. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik married the Netziv's also granddaughter. Anyways, So the Netziv was very unique as a Rosh Yeshiva in many ways. And he wrote a commentary in the Sheiltot, a book that nobody had opened up in 1,000 years. I mean, maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but it probably isn't much of an exaggeration. Sheiltot was the first Gaonic work written after the Talmud, the first major work. And it was sort of an ignored work. And the Netziv wrote a commentary on it when he was a youngster. Brilliant. That showed his brilliance. Rav Lichtenstein gave shiurim for a couple of years on the Sheiltot and his commentary on the Sheiltot. Anyway, the Netziv, what was also unusual for Rosh Yeshiva in the 19th century, was he wrote a commentary on the Chumash. The commentary on the Chumash is based on his shiurim. He gave a shiur every day in the Lashon Yeshiva on Chumash after davening, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes a day to learn Chumash. It's very unusual. Maybe it's unfortunate that's unusual, but it is unusual. And that's written up in the Emek Dabar. So then, see, even his introduction to Bereshit, even though he doesn't spell it out, he's clearly bothered by the following question. And the question is, the Gemara in Yuma, where it discusses the reason for the destruction of the temple, that's a whole other subject, but we'll focus just on this Gemara. It's what I mean, the reason. But with this Gemara, the famous Gemara, that because of Sinat Chinam, the first temple was destroyed because of the three cardinal sins of idolatry, adultery, and murder. And the Gemara then asks about Mikdash Sheni, but what about the second temple? I don't get it. The Jewish people, Hayu Oskim B'Torah, Mitzvot Ugmilut Chasidim. That's how the Gemara introduces. In the second temple, the Jews were very involved in Torah. They learned Torah, Mitzvot. They kept the Mitzvot of the Torah, and they did Gmilut Chasidim, and they did acts of kindness to one another. They did the basic, the most wonderful things in Judaism. So why in the world was the temple destroyed? Where it says, you know why? Because of Sinat Chinam. Because of whatever causes hatred, needless hatred, apathy, whatever you want to say, l'lam decha, to teach you sheshkula, it's equal. Sinat chinam is equal or even worse than the three cardinal sins of idolatry, adultery, and murder. So that in itself is a powerful gemara. We should stop and think about it and just incorporate what that gemara says. Unbelievable that it's worse, because the gemara says the first temple was rebuilt after 70 years. This temple, we're still waiting, almost 2,000 years later. And the Talmud says every generation they don't rebuild it as if we destroyed it. In other words, you know, we think we're so great. If we would have been alive saying the temple, we have the same sin. If we didn't have the same sin, we'd rebuild the temple, whatever that means. But but that gemara doesn't make any sense. If the Talmud says they were doing gemilut chasadim, isn't Gemilut Chasadim and Sinat Chinam opposites? It's a contradiction. The Gemara says, but in the second temple period, the Jews were involved in acts of kindness, tremendous chesed. So why was it destroyed? Because they didn't get along with one another. They didn't like one another. You just said they liked one another. They helped one another. So then it's Eve. He doesn't ask that question, but that's clearly what's motivating him. He has a one-page introduction to the book of Bereshit, which is a phenomenal introduction. And he says that, you know what the problem is? They did selective chesed, what I call selective chesed. We do great chesed, but only to the people who are in our in-group. The people in our out-group, we have nothing to do with them. So, and he explains that this was the terrible sin of the Second Temple. They were very pious Jews. They were learned. I mean, I don't know if that's whatever. They were pious Jews. But what was the problem? Everybody who was different in their religious practice than they were, they looked down upon. And of course, it was l'shem shemayim, he explains. Of course, they did it for the sake of heaven. After all, you know, I want to service God. And this shmendrik is not serving God. I have to look down upon him. I have to throw stones at him. And I have to, I don't mean that in a literal sense. I mean, you know, I have to figuratively throw stones. And then it seems good. And anybody who was different, they totally excluded him. And he said that was, and he wrote, they were tzaddikim l'shem shemayim. And then he writes something that's beyond powerful. He says, God hates, that's the word he used, God sone, God hates these types of righteous people. God hates the righteous maybe more than any other people who we, in other words, we expect more from the righteous. Maybe because they're righteous, he hates them. He hates them if they do this selective chesed. If you don't believe me, look it up. It's an introduction to the Nesiv. And then why is this the introduction to the book of Bereshit? Because he says, this is what Bereshit is written. That's the theme of Bereshit, to teach you how to get along with people. Abraham prayed for Sodom. That's the example he uses, right? The Torah doesn't begin with the Jewish people. The Torah begins with humanity. You have to get along with everybody. We don't meet Abraham till the 20th generation. And Yitzchak, everybody's making peace treaties and getting along and teaching what we care and how Yaakov treated love and how honestly he worked, et cetera, et cetera. And he says that Sefer Bereshit, which is known as Sefer HaYashar, we're going to read it right up next Shabbos, Beth Hanan, Vasit HaYashar V'atov, do the right and the straight. And Sefer HaYashar is Bereshit, because the difference, we explained this before, a tzaddik is our relationship to God, but a yashar is our relationship to man. And God hates the tzaddikim who aren't yasharim. To be a yashar and not a tzaddik, okay, at least you're halfway there. To be a tzaddik and a yashar, you have nothing. Maybe it's negative, because the famous Gemara in Yuma that discusses the mitzvah to love God. So the Gemara interprets, remember, there are no vowels in the Torah. So the Gemara reads it on a secondary level of interpretation, not to take away from that you have to love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. The second level of interpretation is vi'ihafta, and you shall cause others to love. You should bring the love of God, not that you should love God, but because of your actions, other people will love God. And the Gemara says, how do you do that? It says, if you learn Torah and you do mitzvot and you're honest in business, masav matan benacharim habriyot, you masav matan be'emuna, you do your business dealings faithfully, honestly, you're nacharim habriyot, you get along with people, you're friendly, people say, oh, how wonderful. Well, how wonderful it is that his father, that's what the Gemara says, that's what the way it was, his father who taught him Torah, look what a beautiful person this is because he learns Torah. But if a person learns Torah and he does mitzvot, but he cheats in business, and he doesn't get along, he's gruff, he's mean, he's not friendly, people say, ugh, learning Torah. If you learn Torah, you turn into this is a terrible thing. And I've asked like 50 people, no one's been able to say that I'm wrong, if somebody can. The implication of the Gemara is if you're going to be you're gonna be not honest and you're gonna be not nice and you're gonna cause people to look down on you, it would be better not to keep the mitzvot of the Torah, because by keeping the mitzvot of the Torah, it's a chil Hashem. We know people always say, if he's not religious, okay, it doesn't reflect on Torah. But when somebody, I hate to use the stereotypes, but you'll know where I'm coming from, you know, a guy with a long beard and a big kippah and the talus over the head and does something very unbecoming, it's much, much worse. So that's what the Netziv is alluding to, this idea that they were tzaddikim and not yisharim, and that's what caused it to be matzdik the din of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why God had to destroy them. So that's how he explains, see, not, you can do tremendous acts of kindness, they did, but it's got to be universal. You can't only do acts of kindness to your own community. And this is a beautiful, you know, Netziv. I first heard this from Rabbi Blau, actually, the Mashgiach at Yeshiva University. I think he was first one. I didn't know it growing up. I had never heard of. I didn't really know much about the Netziv growing up. We weren't exposed to him in school. When I came to Yeshiva in Israel, a lot of people had the Chumash of the Netziv, the Emet Dever. That's when I first sort of heard about him. And I remember Rabbi Blau saying, you know, it should be posted on the entrance to every shul. You know, this Netziv is, you know, to welcome you into shul. But anyway, so that's sinat habriyot. So that can kill you. Yetzer hara, ayin hara, sinat habriyot can kill you. Okay, the Rambam has a different definition of sinat habriyot. It didn't say sinat chinam. I mean, that was the Bartanura said it's the same, sinat briyot. And by the way, sinat briyot is a broader category. It includes all of creations. It's not just like, you know, people. But okay, the Rambam says sinat habriyot means you don't like people. Not that I'm negative. It's a similar idea. It's a person's a loner. You have nothing to do with the community. Sinat habriyot. I don't care. I leave me alone. Everybody knows if you have neighbors, they don't want to talk to anybody. They don't want to say hello to you, etc. Like that. So that's how he explains it. It's interesting. The Rambam is the one who if you learn Hilchot Tshuva, so the Rambam makes it clear, Rav Soloveitchik has a whole article about this, the distinction between, the parallel tracks of the individual to do Tshuva and the community to do Tshuva. Individuals have to work on themselves, and community, the halach is the Sir Mishtaleach, the goat, on Yom Kippur, atones even for people who don't repent. That's how the Rambam, you know, paskins, except for very, very serious sins, karet, it atones. And why does it atone? Because as long as you're part of a community, you get atonement as part of the community, even if you yourself are a sinner. Karet means I've separated from the community. A Jew who doesn't have a brit milah, saying I'm not really Jewish, right? The 36 sins of the Torah, most of them meant, most of them are either sexual sins, actually, we were talking about before, or avodah zarah, these two areas. Those, most of the 36 karets are either in different forms of idol worship or misworship of God, or it involves different forms of sexual immorality. Then you have like eating on Yom Kippur, eating, a Jew eats on Yom Kippur means I'm not part of the Jewish people. Eating chametz on Pesach. A Jew doesn't keep kosher. Okay, he doesn't keep kosher. It doesn't remove him from part of the people. So that's what the Rambam says. As long as you don't do Isur Karet, your sins are atoned, even if you, you eat ham and bacon and, you know, and you shave with the ray, I don't know, you do all kinds of things that are inappropriate and you don't daven, who knows what. That's the kapara, the tzibur. So it's very, I think when the Rambam is saying that, sinat b'riyot means you're not part of the community, and that's a terrible thing. You have to be part of the community. Community influences, hopefully, to do well. The Bartanura then adds another explanation. What does it mean, sinat b'riyot? To act in a way that people will hate you. It's a, sort of an interesting explanation. Sinat b'riyot means you don't care what people think about you. You act in a way, it's also, obviously, that happens when you're not nice, but to act in a way that you don't care what people have to think about you. On the, okay, all right, that's enough, I think, for that Mishnah. Ein hara, look well on other people. Yetzer hara is good if it's used properly. By the way, the yetzer hatov can also be improper. We do the al chet, al yetzer hatov also. Sometimes the desire to do good can be too much, can be actually a little bit sinful. So everything in its proper proportion. We need a yetzer hara, but not too much, not to run loose. The Gemara says that the Torah is the tavlin of the yetzer hara. God created a yetzer hara. We need it. Yetzer hara is good, very good. But then we have to channel it. And the way we channel the Yetzer Hara is through Torah. That's how the Gemara in Tanit, I should have said that earlier. That's how the Gemara in Tanit explains it, that the Yetzer Hara, the Torah, channels our Yetzer Hara. Yes, so everything, or the Gemara in Chulin says that for everything that was God gave a prohibition, he gave something else which is similar you are allowed to do. In other words, God doesn't negate our desires. He just channels them into a certain area. And that's true in every area of life. So we have ways to satisfy our Yetzer Hara, but it's got to be done in the proper way of Torah. So the Yetzer Hara is needed. Ein Hara, we don't need so much. That I don't think is good at all. And Sinat HaBriyot is not good at all either. Okay, let's move on to the next Mishnah. For those who live in Canada, I think it's a very appropriate Mishnah. for what's going on in the headlines here. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Yehi Mamon Chavercha Chaviv Alach Kishalach, that the money of your friend should be as dear as your own money. Hatken Atzvecha L'mot Torah, prepare yourself to learn Torah, Sheina Yerushalach, it's not an inheritance to you. And everything you do should be for the sake of heaven. Okay, so the first thing he says, Rav Yossi, again, the continuing the five students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, the money of others should be as dear to you as your own money. That doesn't need any commentary. You have to be careful with other people's money. It means, especially people who have the ability, what can I do with your money? So, it means if I'm working in the investment industry. So I'll make investment suggestions to you that aren't in your best interest because it gives me a big commission, or I try to sell you a house that's not really appropriate so I can make money. So obviously those would be violations of these notions and giving bad advice. You know, obviously you'd violate. But most people, I can't affect your money. What do you mean I should be careful with your money? Bill Gates doesn't ask me to spend his money. Like, so I'd have to be careful. But what it means is you work in government and you have billions or trillions of dollars to spend. And how do you spend it? Do you, when you go on trips, do you pay for it yourself or do you have charities pay for your trips? What do you do? How do you spend money? Or do you get the taxpayer to pay for your taxes in your swimming pool in your private residence? That's mean, are you careful with the money of others that you're with careful with yourself that you would spend? It's rather obvious. We always say, especially in Pirkei Avot, the obvious needs stating the most. The Mesilat Yesharim, that's his introduction. The what's considered today the most popular, greatest Musar Sefer, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the Mesilat Yesharim, the path of the straight, however they translate it. So he writes, he's not going to say anything new. Everything I read in this book, everybody knows. But we have to say what's important over and over again. Everybody knows that. Unfortunately, the Nazis taught that a lot. That's how propaganda works. You say it over. You have to say the same ideas over and over again. The Vilna Gaon made an acute comment. The Vilna Gaon said that point, Mesilat Yesharim, he's wrong. It's not true that everything he writes in the book is well known. He had such great insights; they weren't well known. Okay, whatever. But that's rather obvious. But it's very hard. It's very hard to be careful with other people's money. Everybody knows that. Or it's the idea we steal from the public. You know, when I was a kid, you go to a hotel, you take the soap with you or the towels or whatever. Now, who cares? Or because people aren't, the same person would never in a million years, like pickpocket or steal your money. That same person might cheat on their taxes, or that same person might declare and not make a declaration at the border, because you're not really stealing, you're just taking from the public, which of course is worse. Halachically, that's worse. We don't feel it. And we know the Gemara says you can't do any tshuva for that, because even if I pay back the money, the budget was set and how many CAT scan machines they're going to have. In other words, I can't, when you harm the public, you can't pay back, because you're paying back to the public is always changing. So, okay, be careful. Okay. I find this a fascinating expression. Prepare yourself to learn Torah. She'ina Yerushalach. It's not your inheritance. So maybe I'll start with the second part. Torah is not an inheritance. Sometimes it is. Torah Tzivalanu Moshe Morashak, Hilat Yaakov. It is an inheritance. By the way, it's not an inheritance. That's the difference between a Morasha and a Yerusha. Torah Tzivalanu Moshe, it's a Morasha. It's a heritage. A heritage is something you have to pass on to another. A Yerusha is you get money from your parents and you spend it however you want. So the Torah is a Morasha, but it's not a Yerusha. But it also, they're talking about totally different things. The Torah is not an inheritance. In other words, if you want to, here we're talking about the study of Torah, you don't get it by osmosis. Just because your father was a Torah scholar or your mother doesn't mean you'll become a Torah scholar. As a matter of fact, the Gemara in the Darim says, why is it that usually the children of great Torah scholars are not great Torah scholars? Usually the children don't measure up to the parents. Moshe Rabbeinu, you want to start Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu's children, actually, in Pasuk and Shoftim, Rashi points out, were involved in Avodah Zarah. It's almost When people hear this for the first time, they flip out. What, are you crazy? But if you look in, I think in the 18th parak in Shoftim, there's a Menashe by Pesel Micha, I think. There's a whole story there, and it's spelled Menashe, and the Nun is hanging, and it's B'nai Menashe, and the Rashi says it's really B'nai Moshe. They just put in the Nun to cover up for Moshe. Of course, he's revealing the cover up. In other words, it's an allusion to Moshe, because the children of Moshe did idol worship. But as I said, idol worship in the time of the Nevi'im often meant the yearning for God, just misplaced. But their children, you know, they didn't become of much. But okay, forget Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara says that very rarely is it that great Torah scholars have children who are great Torah scholars. So people should know. Torah is not a Yerusha. Torah is not an inheritance. Not like money. It's also not true. Also money, you know, 85% of businesses don't make it to a third generation. I think at most 15% make of successful businesses. Everybody knows successful business. We know in our lifetime, and I made the misfortune of buying Research in Motion. You remember that company, right? Before BlackBerry. So I bought shares in Research in Motion. What can you do? You know, it was the world's leading company. It made Apple look like a joke, and now it's barely hanging on. So things turn upside down. But the Gemara says that Torah is not a Yerusha. You have to work hard on it. And the way to work hard is to see all these great Torah scholars, their children are not Torah scholars. I don't know. I haven't done a statistical study. It often is true. But I think in recent generations, it's probably less true. Probably we live in an era, I would say the last, maybe, I don't know, last couple hundred years, where, you know, you think of families and often the kids don't measure up. But I would say usually the kids don't measure up. But it does seem to have an advantage if your parents were great Torah scholars, your father great Torah scholars. But I think enough isn't. And I think if it does, it's actually a distortion of what the Torah is meant to be. In other words, the learning Torah is meant to be democratic. I've mentioned this before. People have a misconception, especially, let's say, take 19th century Eastern European yeshiva, Balazhin, let's say. We're talking about the Netziv, the great yeshiva in Balazhin. The vast majority of students who studied in Balazhin were wealthy. Because if you weren't in enough money, you couldn't afford it. I mean, the whole kolel system is only because people have money. We're in the richest Jewish community in the history of the world. So, you know, people went to work at 14, at 12, became a friend. Who went learning? That was like unheard of. And who could afford it? And I mentioned very often when a rabbi negotiated a contract, part of the contract was how many students he would be allowed to learn with. How much could the community afford? How big is the day school? We can only afford we talk about day school, the same problem. Not everybody got quote unquote in the day school education. A lot of the cheders were terrible schools. We know that. And it was not all of them, and only people who had money. So the people who learned in yeshivas were often very, very well connected. And even, and if they didn't have so much money or someone was really, really bright, and they felt he could go in yeshiva, so he would marry into wealthy families. That's how it worked. The wealthy, they wanted a Talmid Chacham for their daughter. But that's not really how Torah was sort of meant to be. So in such a system, you're going to create much more of a, that was in Nani Helkot Shir yesterday, and Malachim dynasties, you know, like one child, inherits the Rosh Yeshiva. That's not good. I think one of the great things of Yeshiva University is how it's not a family business. Most yeshivas are, and I don't mean to disparage it. I mean, I don't agree with the approach, but I understand how it happened. But many of the great yeshivas are really family business. I'm not saying they're in it to make money, God forbid. That's not what I mean. But they're owned and controlled by the families. And the son becomes, or the son-in-law becomes the next yeshiva. And I don't have to name yeshivas. The greatness of Yeshiva University is not like that at all. There's a board of directors, an independent. There's almost nobody in yeshiva where a father and son taught in the yeshiva. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik, okay, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Yosef Dov Ber Soloveitchik. But almost none of the Rebbeim, people there are on merit, and many of them come from families where their parents, you know, were not great Torah scholars. So that's how that's going to work. But when we have a system, only the wealthy can learn. It's not like that. Anyways, that's a I pardon if you don't agree with my social commentary, you can ignore that. But hopefully the Torah you'll agree with. But what the Mishnah is saying is Torah is not Yerush, you got to work hard. Anybody who is a Talmid Chacham, even if they have the advantage, and of course it helps, of a parent who's a great scholar. You know, I think it was in Malcolm Gladwell's book, you know, Outliers. It's a fascinating book. I don't know how many people read it. You know, where he shows the trends in society. You know, he starts on the hockey one. That's the... We're living in Canada. I think the hockey season starting next week. Baseball started last night. No, I won't comment on any of that. But so, you know, he pointed out that most NHL hockey players, at least years ago when they were all Canadian, I guess, you know, 75% were born January, February, March. I think I once mentioned that. Birthdays, because everything's the luck of the draw, because when you're 6 years old in peewee hockey and they make the all-star team, so the guy born in January is going to be better at December, you know, go by the year, the school year. In grade one, the kid born in January is a huge advantage over a kid born in December. He's like 20% older than he is, you know. In grade 13, grade 12, you know, grade 13, doesn't really matter anymore, but in grade one and two it matters. That's why some parents sometimes hold back their kids. Kid born in January, they don't want the kid to be the oldest. I'm sorry, they want the kid to be the oldest in the class. They don't want to push ahead necessarily. So anyway, so he writes there, to be a major league baseball player, if your father was a major league baseball player, you have an 800 times greater chance of being a baseball player yourself. We all know that in sports, how many fathers and sons and brothers. The Souther brothers, six brothers, made it to the NHL. Okay, pardon my sports analogies. But so there clearly does help if your parents are great Torah scholars. But so that's why the Gemara is going out of the way. So many are not. And that's true even today. So many great Torah scholars have children who are, I don't want to say are nobodies, but they don't measure up in learning. Okay, now what's Hatken Atzmecha L'Lumot Torah? Prepare yourself to learn Torah. Like, it's an interesting expression. So I think what it means, and this is, we've discussed a little bit, you know, the greatness of Daf Yomi, but the pitfalls in Daf Yomi. Hatken Atzmecha L'Lumot Torah, prepare yourself to learn Torah. It's not enough to learn Torah. I mean, that's wonderful. You have to have a system. You have to prepare. I want to accomplish something. What's the best way to accomplish it? And you have to have, what am I going to learn? What's the curriculum going to be? And by the way, that is a major fault in many of the yeshivas. You just learn. Because when yeshivas were only for the elite, in Valazhin, in order to get into Valazhin, my understanding was you had to pass a test of 400 blot. That's 400 double-sided pages, Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfot. You know, a faher, as they say. You had to pass that. And then you can come into yeshiva. And then today, most people who get smicha would fail such a test. And that was the entrance exam. You know, I don't know exactly, whatever, they examined people. So they didn't need a curriculum. When you're brilliant, you don't need a curriculum. But average people need a curriculum. They have to, I actually, if I can say that, I think that's one of the major advantages of the university over the yeshivot. In yeshivas, often the goal is the kid should learn. And in the university, the goal is the kid should learn something. In other words, in yeshiva, that he's learning, not knowledge per se, that he's learning. He's engaged in the act of learning. It's the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. It's not what he learns. And the university focuses on accomplishments. You have to finish a curriculum. Very few yeshivas have a curriculum. There are Rosh Yeshivas who do have that. Many yeshivas disdain tests. I got an email recently. I don't know, so many email lists. So some yeshiva was writing, you know, in our yeshiva, they're opening up, I think, in the yeshiva for American kids. In our yeshiva, no test. Or I think maybe it was a high school, a new high school. No test, because, you know, tests are bad. I don't know. That's not, in my vision, that's not Hatken Atzmecha L'Lumot Torah. You have to have a plan. And as I met Rav Zevin in one of his beautiful articles, all his articles are beautiful. Rav Zevin writes that there's a mitzvah to learn Torah, but there's also a mitzvah to know Torah. They're two separate mitzvot. Hopefully, if you're smart, you can do them both at the same time. But there is something to be engaged in Torah, even if you don't learn. Schar halicha, going to a shir you don't understand. Seeing the power of Torah, being engaged with other people. That's beautiful, even if you yourself gain very little. That's a nice mitzvah. But there's a second mitzvah, to know Torah. And for that Torah, you have to be hatken atzmecha. You have to prepare yourself. You have to plan in advance. And the Mishnah, Pirkei Avot, does that. The Mishnah says at the age of five, you start on Tanakh. At the age of 10, you start Torah Shebal Peh. To start Torah Shebal Peh, before 10, kids are too young. And you know what? Torah Shebal Peh means the Mishnah means straight halacha. This is what you do. This is what you don't do. These are the 39 milachot of Shabbat. To discuss Yehu Shalom Idat, to discuss Gemaras, that's only age 15. And the that's what the Gemara says, the Mishnah. Why we've totally changed that system is a very good question. It was probably not such a good idea. The one who rallied against this working away from a curriculum was the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal of Prague was very upset. The Maharal of Prague was very upset that the Maharal of Prague died in 1609, if I'm not mistaken. And and he lived, I think, a long life. So the Maharal of Prague, the printing presses, the first Talmud was printed in 1523. So what gets printed on the side of the Talmud? So Rashi. Okay, Rashi has to get printed. What's next? No, I don't know. So they printed Tosfot. So many people were very up. The Maharal thought this is terrible. Tosfot, that's dialectical learning, complicated, complex, and nothing to do with the daf. Tosfot doesn't explain what you're learning. I mean, Tosfot says what you're learning. Oh, how can you say this? There's a Gemara in a different tractate that says something else that contradicts. So I'm going to give you an answer. This Gemara is talking about it. You can totally understand your Gemara without Tosfot. You can't understand Gemara without Rashi. Why not put the Rosh? Why not put other commentaries that explain the daf? So the Gemara was very, he said it hurt the learning because kids were started asking all kinds of questions. They weren't learning the proper things. It's interesting, you know, how these things happen, you know, what the influence is. By the way, the Maharal's brother, Rav Bezalel, I think was his name. He was like, it sounds like today. I mean, you smile. He thought the printing press was terrible, just like people thought the internet was terrible. I said, terrible. It's going to destroy Judaism, the printing press. Why will it destroy Judaism? So he had two concerns. Number one is you don't need rabbis. Rabbi Google, rabbi printer. You don't need, who needs a teacher anymore? I just opened up my Sansino Talmud. That's what it was called, right? That's why Sansino city in Italy, printing presses. I opened my, wasn't in English, but I opened up my Sansino or the, you know, Talmud, and I don't need a rabbi. Number two, he was very afraid. Remember that that Sephardic culture would overwhelm Ashkenazi culture. There were many more Sephardim in the world then. So the generation after the expulsion from Spain, I think, had 90% of world Jewry. So the Sephardim greatly outnumbered Ashkenazi. And it was very people were going to read, oh, I'm going to eat kidney and I'm Pesach. Why do I have to follow these minhagim and worms and mines? Let's eat kidney on Pesach. Let's do this. Let's do that. So it's very, we laugh at this because how ridiculous when we get the printing press. And we laugh at people who are against the internet because it's against the, you can't be against these things. Of course, at the time, everybody's again, but it becomes so real. So anyways, so you have to have a whole system. The Maharal was very upset and he felt the printing of Tosfot, there needs a curriculum to learn, not just learn. And you know what? Not everybody has to learn Gemara. The idea that everybody has to learn Gemara, this is a modern post-World War II innovation. Never in history was it expected that everybody learned Gemara. Okay, enough of my personal comment. I know Pirkei Avot gives me the ability or the curse or to really, you know, give my own much more editorial comments than if I was giving a Chumashir or a Halachashir, but whatever. Okay, let's just do a little bit more, then I'll take the questions and we'll wrap up. Where are we up to here? So, everything you do should be the sake of heaven. So we discussed already the importance of L'Shem Shemaim, that we said it really doesn't matter if you do it for the wrong reasons. It's good to do mitzvah. I mean, it's fine to do mitzvah for the wrong reason is because from the wrong reason you come to the right reason. We explained, I think, even last week or 2 weeks ago, that's only normal people. Leaders, we started with leadership and being concerned with money of others. Leaders, it's very different. Leaders have to be properly motivated. Me and you don't have to be properly motivated. But the people in government have to be extremely properly motivated because every decision they make hurts people by definition. You give money here, you take money there. That's what they have to do. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. As long as they're doing it lishma and l'shem shemayim. You can make a difficult decision. Decision might even be wrong. but at least you're purely motivated, that's okay. So that's one type. But obviously you should do mitzvot l'shem shemayim, but the truth of the matter, the commentators, that's not what our Mishnah is talking about. This idea of doing mitzvot. That was the idea. When you do something, a mitzvah, doing it lishma, not lishma. Here are the commentators explaining when we're talking about our quote-unquote, our secular activities. When we eat, when we play, we do things, that should be done also l'shem shemayim. In other words, it's worshiping God, you have to have a wholesome lifestyle. You have to exercise. The Rambam paskins, that if I can use that term, a Jew has to exercise every day. That's shmartem l'nashotechem. Somebody told me the other day, they're more concerned with eating healthy than keeping kosher. I said, great. That's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. So the Shulchan Aruch says. The Shulchan Aruch, in the beginning of Yoredei and Chelek Bey, says that it's based on the Gemara. The Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch didn't make it up. Gadol sakanta me isura. Something that is dangerous is more prohibited. The Shulchan Aruch, there's a whole list of things you're not allowed to do because it's dangerous. Something that's more dangerous, you have to be more careful than the prohibition. So eat pork, big, I don't want to say big deal, but I can say that in a crowd where people keep kosher, you know? So eat pork, it's not gonna harm you. I mean, harm you, of course, in a spiritual sense, whatever, but I mean, even that's hard to measure. It's not gonna harm you, but if you do things that are dangerous, so that you have to. So you have to live a healthy lifestyle, but everything you do when you exercise, that can also be done the shem shemayim, you know? Rev Lichtenstein used to play basketball. Or when I was in Or Chaim, when I went to high school in Toronto, Rev Tabori Aleva Shalom, my Rosh Hashiva, he was a great baseball fan, and he was a very good basketball player. And we used to play, of course, what do kids do in high school? We were more interested in basketball than in Gemara, most kids, I don't know. But he used to play basketball with us on occasion, because it's not just to be one of the boys and to et cetera, but also how you play basketball can say a lot about a person. How a person drives can tell you, you know, there are midot in everything you do. Even eating, drinking, playing baseball, whatever you do can be done l'shem shemayim. So that's what the Mishnah says there. Chol ma'asecha. There's this idea when you do mitzvot, sometimes you do mitzvot, not the shem shemayim. And that's, we said, that's the whole thing. Okay, it's not ideal, but it's fine as long as you're not harming people in the way. That's to do mitzvot, not the shem shemayim. Mitzvot ideally the shem shemayim, but even eating and our activities should be done the shem shemayim. Okay, let me just see. I think maybe there were a couple of questions here, not too many, and then I can just do a quick review. Is there a Hebrew equivalent word for the Yiddish of shtender? I have no idea. They don't have shtenders anymore so much, do they, right? How do you say shtender in English? I don't even know. The shtender, right? Where the chazan davens from. When I came to high school, we used to learn from a shtender. I can't believe it. It's like hard to believe. You didn't have a table yet. Like, I don't know what the word is in English. A wooden thing, you know, what like the chazan davens from. Anyways, I don't know.
A podium.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you. No. Okay, thank you, Howard. Okay, I believe it was Rava and not Rav who made the shir with the joke. I have to check. I know it's in Shabbos, Dave. If you're right, I will apologize. Okay, what's that question? Rav Lichtenstein, what does the Rav think? And he gave me a lengthy interview with Salvation. He needed to clarify that I was seeking his opinion and not that of his father-in-law. Okay. I'm not sure in what context was. Yeah, his opinion. By the way, the Rav expected people to form their own opinions. Whatever. Is there any discussion about a kippah should look like? No, I don't think so. I mean, maybe it's unfortunate. A kippah has become very much, it's symbols. Like I will say, Rav Soloveitchik has a beautiful idea. About the Israeli flag, right? I'll say this for a minute. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was not a Zionist, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the greatest posek in America, an unbelievable person, but he wasn't in the modern Orthodox, what we would call the modern Orthodox religious Zionist world. Okay, Seder. So Rav Moshe was asked if you can have an Israeli flag in a shul. You know, somebody got upset, the rabbi put an Israeli flag, you know, it's a kaif. So Rav Moshe writes this unbelievable tshuva. Ramosha writes, you know, of course the Zionists were terrible people and they wanted to uproot Torah. You know, that was the mindset, the secular Zionists. And it was not totally false. They wanted to uproot Torah, create a secular Jew. They took all the Moroccan Jews. They sent them to secular kibbutzim. The Zionists were evil, terrible people, of course. Nonetheless, It's we don't want to have a machloket about it, and you're not allowed to make a fight about it. And it's okay. They have the Israeli flag, they have the American flag, and Shul Beseder. You shouldn't leave and make an issue over it. Soloveitchik talked about the Israeli flag. So he said the Israeli flag has holiness to it, kedusha to it. What Rav Soloveitchik was from the religious Zionist world, of course. And Rav Soloveitchik explained based on a Rambam. The Rambam says that if a Jew, Chas V'Sholom, is murdered by non-Jews, you bury him in his blood-stained clothes to be Mu'orah the Rachamim, to get the mercy of God. So you bury this person, you don't take off the clothes, he gets buried in the blood. And he said the Israeli flag, unfortunately, is wrapped with so much blood, so the Israeli flag has the kiddusha, and therefore the flag itself becomes holy. So symbols can become very important. So a kippah, halachically, I mean, you don't even have to, again, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a well-known tshuva. I don't think it's really true anymore. I don't know if he would write the same thing, that if it's going to impede your job prospects, you don't have to wear a kippah. And as in the 80s, when my friends were going on interviews in law firms and in New York, it was very well known. Everybody told them to take off their kippahs. I know people. They went on job interviews wearing kippahs. They went on 5 interviews and got no job offers. Then they went on 3 interviews with their kippahs off and they got 3 job offers. Coincidence? I don't know. So, you know, that Rav Moshe writes a kippah, it's a minag, it's okay. You don't have to lose any livelihood over it. Today, Baruch Hashem, I don't think that's true. Today, we live in a multicultural society. People can dress how they want, what they want. So I don't think it really harms you. But on the other hand, the Taz, living in the 17th century, has a famous comment that not to wear it, that's Rav Moshe says, it isn't true anymore. That's what Rav Moshe is discussing. He starts with the Taz. The Taz, the commentary in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav David Siegel, the Turei Zahab, so he was a Levi, so he says that not to wear a kippah is a biblical prohibition of Chukat HaGoyim. Wow. Biblical prohibition of Chukat HaGoyim. Why? Because the goyim insist when you go to church, you have to uncover your head. You know, they play the national anthem. You know, you have to take your kippah. You have to take your hat off when they play the national anthem. So that's a religious, non-Jewish custom. So a Jew who goes with bareheaded, that's a biblical violation. Wow. So Rav Moshe, not true anymore. In other words, symbols can have halakhic implications later on. But no, there is no halakhas about a kippah. By the way, a friend of mine once said that's probably the reason why only men and women don't wear kippot generally, because the custom, he said that the kippot was really a reaction to the church. And in the Gospels, it says that men, when they enter the church, have to take off their head, they can't have head coverings. It was only addressed to men. Barak is only men. This is what he told me. Only men went to church. So if the men had to take off their kippah, so Jewish men, B'davka, wore a kippah, you know. And the Pope, of course, wears a kippah. There is something, but only the Pope, I guess. Whatever. So, no, is there any discussion about what a kippah should look like? I don't think so. So, if you like, here I have a kippah sruga, so I guess I am identifying with the religious Zionist movement. Okay, that's who I want to identify with, whatever. But I think we make way too much out of it, unfortunately. Okay, is Rabbi Lezer relating to the way he was treated to the Avena Bachnai? Somebody asked me privately, you're asking in terms of what? To be careful with your friend. Very interesting. Rabbi Elezer says, be very honor of your friend. Maybe he's a reaction to the way they mistreated him. Could very well be. Okay, very interesting. Is this Torah study? When the rabbis prayed for sexual drive to go away, the chicken stopped laying eggs. Yeah, that's what we said. Only about 2,000 years before Crazy Jane Bishop. I'm not sure what that means. Karet was Rashay Tevot. No, Karet just means to be cut off. And Nichrotu, Lichrot. Cut off, there are 36 things in the Torah you get Karet for. 34 of them are prohibitions. 2 of them are positive mitzvot. If you die or don't do a brit milah, and then bring a Korban Pesach. And you know, one who doesn't have a brit milah can't bring the Korban Pesach. 34 negative, 44.
I think I found it.
I've said it's... If somebody wants to ask, I'll give you 1 second. That's it. Yeah. Just let me quickly review very quickly. We talked about Ayin Hara, things that can kill you, take you from this world, the way you look at others, being jealous, the Yetzer Hara, when the Yetzer Hara is good, when the Yetzer Hara is not good, and the praying to get rid of the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, its impact on our worship of God. But we need a little bit of Yetzer Hara Torah, even a Yetzer HaTov, because it isn't always good. Hatred, a people. So hatred of people can be apathy. It's the opposite of love. We discussed in the Tziv's introduction what sinat chinam means. It's selective. You can do as the people did. You can do chesed and still be full of sinat chinam. They're not contradictory ideas. And then we discussed a little bit, careful with other people's money, of course, to prepare yourself to learn Torah. Torah is not an inheritance. Children often aren't following in the path, aren't blessed to be great Torah scholars. Everything we do should be L'shem Shemaim, not just in the religious, what we call religious. In Judaism, we don't really distinguish in religion and secular. Playing baseball can also be a religious activity. It's done in the prospect of living a proper, healthy lifestyle. It's all wonderful. Okay.